Part 21, Chapter 7. They had just completed the installation of a radio telescope when the courier came in. Angus, his face red, first from sun at lake level and then from wind and snow up at the summit of nearby Mount Elgon, was very proud of himself. The German and Swedish pilots, with something to do besides train under the relentless storm along, had helped find and install the huge reflector bowls and relays from the peaks and down to the mine site. Now that they had the frequencies, Angus was saying, they would soon be hearing everything those monkeys up there were saying to each other. He'd even have them on the screens. Johnny's ear caught the far-off approach of the plane above the overcast. He thanked Angus and the pilots and said they had done very well. And yes, now maybe they would know more about the intentions of their visitors. Glenn Cannon had taken over the ferrying of the vital discs from America. A copy was now going to Dr. McDermott to bury in a deep underground vault, and the originals were coming through to Johnny in Africa. Glenn Cannon had lots of news. Patty had been extremely ill for weeks, but Chrissy was nursing her, and there was hope. And Chrissy sent her love and said she'd found a lovely old house right near Castle Rock, and some of the chief's wives were helping her find real furniture in old ruins, and she sent her love, and when was he coming back? Castle Rock was now so surrounded with anti-aircraft blast cannon, it made one fair nervous to fly near it. Dunaldine? Oh, he was flying the pants off new recruits, but there weren't as many coming in now. Mostly machine operators were getting trained. Kerr was fine and sent him some brand new air masks he'd made that fit better, and said not to turn him in for stealing company materials, ha ha. And here were some personal letters for Sir Robert. And here was the latest set of you-know-whats. Johnny went deep underground and got the discs rolling. They had the place well set up now. Watching the female cyclos, while not letting them handle anything vital, they had learned the use of some of the office machinery they had earlier ignored, and they could copy discs and make blow-ups of sections with a fine-line accuracy they had not thought possible. They had cabinets for files, and all in all, they could make the discs talk much better. Turl. He was sitting there doing force equations. Incomprehensible. The equations didn't balance and didn't make any sense. He was filling pages and pages with them. Still, nothing to do with teleportation. Johnny almost skimmed by it. He backtracked. The pictures showed Turl getting up, going over to the cabinet, and opening up another false bottom. He took out a huge sheet of paper, so big it would take three scanners' views to encompass it. The paper was very old, creased until it nearly fell apart, stained brown, and faded. Turl spread it out, looked at it, and then shook his head over it. He traced one claw along the north side of the big dam, way to the southwest of the American mine site. He nodded. Then he wadded the paper up and threw it at the shredder bin. He wrote down some footage figures and some voltage figures, and then went back to his equations, and it was just equations for the next 2 days. And that was all there was in the discs. It took an hour of patching from three different scanner channels to get it. But Johnny recovered the huge piece of paper in its entirety and got a half dozen huge copies of it. It was entitled Defense Installations of Planet Number 203,534. Johnny knew already that was the cyclo name for Earth. It showed every mine site, every dam, every gun battery, and every... a little symbol that trailed around each dam and below each power line from dams to mine sites and branch mine sites. Johnny had no idea what that symbol was. But there was a goodie he had never dreamed of. Marked, clearly, was a firing transshipment platform. He compared the cyclo mass of numbered locations with a man map of ancient times. The second platform was alongside a dam which had once been named Kariba, in a country which had once been called Rhodesia, and then Zimbabwe. The platform was marked Emergency Defense Armament Receipt Point. Obviously, if the main mine site were ever knocked out, Cyclo could send in another force, or the Cyclo command on the planet could demand troops or at least inform the Home Office. Hopes soaring, but a little held down by the age of the map and Turl's treatment of it. Johnny had a Marine attack plane on the line, and Scots piling into it. Robert the Fox boarded hastily. Just as they were about to close the door, McKendrick piled in with a medical kit. Johnny sent the plane racing to the south. It was only about 1,000 miles away, and it only took them 35 minutes to spot the huge dam and lake and the mammoth installation. Some distance to the south and east of that, they saw what had been called Victoria Falls, one of the biggest waterfalls on the planet. Spectacular country. Because the area had been marked heavily defended, Johnny approached it cautiously. It was another branch mine they hadn't known the existence of. They found the compound some distance to the east and landed a platoon with assault rifles and radiation ammunition to make a cautious approach. A half hour later, they had the report on mine radio. The place was deserted and, the platoon officer reported, not much different from the one in the Ituri forest to the north. The map had not shown the second platform at the mine site, but it was quite close to the huge dam. They took the platoon back aboard, and Johnny began to cruise the area. Trees, trees, trees. This was a high plateau, but not an open plain. Trees had been knocked down in swaths where elephant herds had passed through. There were lots of little hills. Everything was masked with undergrowth, except a few open places. Cruising along, elephant and African buffalo looking up at them, Johnny searched and searched. He had found before that it was one thing to look at a map and quite another to be on the ground, and he was experiencing it again. Time after time, he studied the map while Stormalong in the co-pilot's seat kept them cruising above the treetops. Johnny finally got out some dividers and very carefully measured the distance from the dam edge, and then, taking the plane to that point and cruising it at the speed a horse walks, finally got them in the center of what must have been the point. Stormalong threw out a smoke flare to mark it, and a couple of big elephants took off. It was a bowl in the ground, the edges of which rose about 200 feet above the middle. It was like a crater, possibly even made with a bomb blast. It was about 1,000 feet in diameter. The bowl itself was so overgrown, one could not see what was in it. But as the white smoke spired up, the truth hit Johnny. For centuries, perhaps, the company security officers of this planet had paid no attention to maintaining the elaborate planetary company defenses which once existed. No wonder Turl had thrown the map away. He looked so disappointed that Sir Robert tried to cheer him up.
We won't really know until we look closer.
But it certainly was wilderness, receiving no care for centuries. Johnny put them down on the upper edge of the crater, and with riflemen ready to handle any hostile game, others got axes and began to hack their way down.
Be careful around here, said Dr. McKendrick. This area had an insect called the tsetse fly that brought on sleeping sickness. Also, the water had a worm in it that gets into the bloodstream. I don't have much in the way of medicines, but wear nets and stay out of the water.
Great,
said Johnny. That was all they needed. They cut their way down to the center of the bowl. They passed one of the transshipment holes 3 times before they spotted it. They paced out in various directions and located another 2. The 4th was easy. Johnny took a shovel and started down through the humus. He was hoping the company maxim of never salvage anything would hold true. 2 feet of dead leaves and humus down, he hit the platform. Axes ringing, they were getting trees and brush out of the way. They found the concrete base of the operations firing dome, and then finally, the dome itself, upside down and some distance away. No console! Wires were eventually uncovered within the concrete base. Typically Cyclo, they were still well insulated when you scraped the mold off. Johnny was struck by the absence of the power lines. There should be power lines coming in from the dam. There was a power channel marked on the map, and also that old squiggle he couldn't identify. Light was failing and they would have kept on, but McKendrick made them get up to high ground. They spent the night listening to elephants trumpeting, lions roaring, and all the other cacophony of a very live jungle. But the night was quite cool, since this plateau had a fairly high altitude. In the morning, they dug a cross-cut trench and found the power line, being careful not to cut into it. They cut another trench and found the same line went on underground to the distant mine site. And there was another cable they couldn't identify that went along with the power line. Flogging their way through the brush, they went over to the huge dam. It was a real soaring monster of a dam. It seemed intact. The spillways were running. There were signs that Cyclos had landed near it and gone in and out the access door to the powerhouse in some recent time. Johnny had never been inside one of these dams before. They vibrated with sheer, raw power. The thunder of the water and the high whine of generators made it impossible to be heard. It was the usual Cyclo conversion, he supposed. It was very, very old, and some bits of the original man equipment that had been cast aside were very much older. Angus found the switchboard and bus bars, a vast, towering affair in a separate control room. Only two of the handles were clean, and it didn't need a little tuft of fur caught in one of them to tell that Cyclos had come here to shut power on and off. But what were all these other bus bars? They got some mine sacks and tried to wipe the panel down without causing short circuits. There were Cyclo letters inset into it. A whole row said, Force Stage 1, Force Stage 2, Force Stage 3. A second row said, Transshipment 1, Transshipment 2, Transshipment 3. Johnny gingerly rubbed some more with a mine sack, careful of closing any gap.
They're color-coded!
He tried to tell Angus this, but there was no talking in this place. They went back out.
Turl,
said Johnny to Angus and Sir Robert,
is working on force equations. There is something on the north side of the American Dam I think he must want. The squiggles on this map must have to do with force.
He sent Angus back into the power control house and placed some Scots along the underground line of squiggles and connected everyone up with mine radios.
Close Force Stage 1!
He radioed to Angus. The effect was far more drastic and dramatic than anything they expected. All inferno broke loose. Along the squiggle line of the map, all around the crater, trees erupted, splintered, soared, crashed. It was as if a bomb had exploded. Trunks and leaves and branches were falling for over a minute afterward. Sir Robert was running to find out what had happened to their spotters. Were they all killed? Their radios had gone silent. It took them an hour to dig the Scots out. One had been knocked unconscious. The rest were bruised and slightly cut. Six had been involved. McKendrick collected them and assessed the damages and began applying the antiseptics and tape. Johnny made his way over to them from the dam. It looked like a first aid station after a battle. The one who had been knocked out had come to now. He had been blown in the air. Johnny apologized to them. The Scot that had been knocked out was grinning.
A little thing like that isn't likely to ruin a Scot,
he said.
What was it?
Yes, indeed. What was it?
Did I do something wrong?
Angus's voice came over the radio. The Scots were all taking it as a joke, so Johnny said,
I think you did something right.
They were out of the area now.
Close that switch again!
A bit of the tree wreckage stirred and moved, and then was still. Johnny cautiously moved toward the bowl, and couldn't leave the dam area. He walked straight ahead, and then he couldn't go any further. He could not walk through the air before him. He threw a rock at it. The rock bounced. He tried again, throwing harder. Same result. He had Angus open the bus bar again. No barrier. Closed. Barrier. For the next 2 hours, by opening and closing the first and second row of bus bars and throwing rocks, they found that the dam itself was surrounded by a protective screen. The bowl had a screen all around its top and was completely enclosed. Riflemen even fired shots at it, and they glanced off. At stage two, the air got a bit shimmery, and Angus reported the power output meters were lower. At stage three, there was a strange electrical smell in the air, and the output meters of the total dam power dropped way down. Defense and more defense. A transshipment platform operating in that bowl could not be interfered with by attack. Not from the sides, and not from above. And neither could the dam. The amount of raw power it took to operate it was a large portion of the total output of this huge dam. And Johnny surmised that they changed stages of output to repel extreme attack, and then eased them off to stage one when they needed power to transship. Johnny had them booby-trap the entrances in case their visitors upstairs came down for a look and a prowl. And they took off in the early afternoon for home. A glimmer of hope. Not much, but a glimmer, Johnny told Sir Robert on the way home. He wanted Sir Robert, Johnny said, to take charge in the African area for the moment, for Johnny had some other things to look into elsewhere. He rebriefed the grizzled war chief on the existing situation. They were threatened by a possible counterattack from Cyclo. The visitors upstairs were waiting for something. He did not know what, but he was certain they would eventually strike. The political scene in America was a lesser menace, but existed, and they had to let it go on for now. The thing that would solve their troubles, Johnny said, was to get control of teleportation, or at least an operating console. With that, they could operate far more widely, but it seemed to be the most closely guarded secret the Cyclos had, and avenues to cracking it were not very hopeful. The main problem, Johnny said, was protecting what was left of the human race. They were no longer very numerous. A wide attack by the visitors or a counterattack by Cyclo could, either one, finish them as a race forever. Johnny, as soon as they landed, was going to leave for Russia to begin to handle this point. Would Sir Robert, Johnny concluded, take a few local protective measures, which Johnny then named. Robert the Fox said he was honored and certainly would. Such things were easily done. But did Johnny much care what happened to any visitors who might wander down? Johnny said no. And Sir Robert smiled.